Thank you very much, Bob, for that generous introduction, and thank you all for coming. 5 weeks ago, some 300 Civil War reenactors in full costume gathered at windswept Fort Sumter, South Carolina, to mark the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the American Civil War. Tourists snapped digital photos of the dignified ceremony and applauded politely as the Stars and Stripes was taken down and replaced by the flag of the Confederacy. The players involved in commemorative exercises at Sumter and nearby Fort Moultrie were happy to explain their involvement in the day's events. Claude Sinclair, acting the part of colorful Confederate commander Pierre Gustave Toutaint Beauregard, stated that he had 9 great-grandfathers who had fought in the war, 6 of whom were killed in battle. Another reenactor recalled that his great-grandfather, just the one, had been a Civil War veteran. It was a great thing, he said, for him to know that his grandmother's eyes had gazed upon someone who had actually fought in the war. So great a thing, in fact, that he had already made arrangements to be buried next to his fighting forebear. Nothing like being prepared, I guess. So memory, history, and the events that led to the coming of the Civil War. These are the subjects of my talk tonight. But first, we need some context. In November of 1860, the election of a Northern president, the Republican candidate Abraham Lincoln, triggered a full-blown secession crisis in the United States. It was a crisis that threatened to destroy the Federal Union created by the Founding Fathers at Philadelphia in 1787. In February 1861, delegates from 7 cotton states met in Montgomery, Alabama, to found a new pro-slavery nation, the Confederate States of America. And by the time Lincoln was inaugurated 16th President of the United States in early March, most federal property in the Deep South was in the hands of the secessionists. Only a few federal forts remained under the authority of the government in Washington. One of these defenses, Fort Sumter, guarding the entrance to the South Carolina port of Charleston, was the flashpoint for war. Shortly after his inauguration, Lincoln found out that the small garrison of United States troops at Sumter was fast running out of provisions. In his first days as president, he faced a situation more perilous than the severe economic crises which confronted Franklin Roosevelt and Barack Obama when they entered the White House. Lincoln's options were limited. He could try to resupply the garrison with food and possibly arms and additional troops and risk initiating civil war. Or he could give the fort up, either with a view to recognizing Confederate independence or prolonging efforts to broker a compromise between the national government and its southern opponents. After a good deal of soul searching, he opted to reprovision the fort, thereby signaling his administration's determination to maintain the last vestiges of its authority in the South. A small fleet of ships left the Brooklyn Navy Yard on the 10th of April. Informed by Washington of the flotilla's approach, the Confederates resolved to exert their own authority within what they now regarded as their own national boundaries. At 4:30 in the morning on the 12th of April, 1861, Confederate shore batteries bombarded the Sumter garrison into submission before the supply vessels arrived. President Lincoln quickly issued a call for troops. Troops to put down what a clear majority of Northerners now regarded as the Southern Rebellion. The war had finally come. Leaders on both sides of the ensuing conflict expected it originally to be a short war, but they were tragically mistaken. The American Civil War turned out to be the bloodiest secession war in history until Nigeria's Biafran conflict in the late 1960s. An estimated 620,000 combatants perished trying to save the Union or to make Southern independence a reality. 50,000 civilians were killed, and tens of thousands of soldiers returned home disabled and disfigured. When the famed Confederate commander Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to his Union counterpart, Ulysses S. Grant, at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia in April 1865, the fighting itself was virtually over. The fact is, however, as last month's Fort Sumter reenactment confirmed, the Civil War has never quite gone away. Which brings me to my central topic, the role played by historical memory in the secession crisis of 1860 to 1861. Memory plays a critical role in all our lives. Remembering the past is something we do all the time. It's part of the fabric of our identity. Our identity as human beings. It's essential to who we are, or at least to who we think we are. Of course, unless someone actually invents time travel, it just isn't possible to relive the past as it actually happened. The past may not literally be a foreign country, as the novelist L.P. Hartley wrote famously in The Go-Between, but it's certainly gone for good. As individuals, we remember it imperfectly and in many different ways. The French sociologist Maurice Altvax, a pioneer in modern memory studies, contended that a person remembers only by situating himself within the viewpoint of one or several groups and one or several currents of collective thought. In other words, memory is a social construction. We recall the past by looking at photographs, talking to friends and family, browsing the internet, listening to the radio, reading books and newspapers, watching TV. Together with the inexorable passage of time and the dictates of our own self-interest, these mediating agents ensure that the same two people can remember the same event in completely different ways. And I use the term remember advisedly, because as individuals, we actually forget or misremember the past far more frequently than we actually remember it. And the same is true of people acting collectively. Historians like me earn a vaguely respectable living, retrieving and interpreting the limited traces of the past that remain. Most of us are comfortable talking about national memory, grand historical narratives of a nation's past that are constructed by significant actors within a specific territorial domain. These actors include powerful ethnic groups and politicians with a stake in peddling a particular interpretation of their country's history. Normally, these official national memories do not go uncontested. Minorities often harbor potent counter-memories, which, for the most part, are ignored or marginalized by groups with greater access to state power. However, changing power relations within a society can alter the way that nations remember their history. An American Civil War memory provides us with an instructive example. In 1961, white Americans, Southerners especially, prepared to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the Civil War. And they did so largely without reference to African Americans. They ignored the role that slavery played in causing the war, the centrality of emancipation to the development of the Lincoln administration's grand strategy, and the contribution of black troops to the Union war effort. Things are somewhat different today. When last year, Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell announced his backing for Confederate History Month, he was immediately assailed for his failure to acknowledge that slavery was to blame for the Civil War. And President Obama was among the governor's leading critics. Right-wing neo-Confederate commemorations of secession have been relatively low-key over the past few months. Recent events like the sesquicentennial ball in Charleston and Secession Day parade in Montgomery were thinly attended and attracted attention from African-American demonstrators carrying placards such as "South Carolina suffers from Confederacy of the mind." The chief difference between 1961 and 2011 is the intervention of the civil rights movement. Because the movement empowered Southern blacks by securing passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, few mainstream politicians today are foolish enough to publicly embrace the neo-Confederate lost cause narrative of the Civil War, an account depicting the conflict as having been fought over states' rights rather than slavery, and one that insists that most slaves were loyal to the Southern cause. Historical memory played an important but only partially acknowledged role in the secession crisis of 1860 to 61. There isn't time tonight for me to embark upon a comprehensive investigation of this topic, you'll be glad to know. So I want to highlight its impact on Northern Republicans at this crucial moment in American history. Let me stress right away that focusing on the Republicans alone will only get us so far towards an understanding of the outbreak of the Civil War. Apart from Northern anti-slavery Republicans and hardline immediate secessionists who wanted to rush the Southern states out of the Union on a state-by-state basis, there were several important players during the Great Secession winter. They included, firstly, more cautious Deep South secessionists, so-called cooperationists. These people opposed hasty action in favor of a coordinated regional response to the Republican victory. Secondly, there were Northern Democrats, including the lame duck President James Buchanan, who occupied the White House between Lincoln's election on the 6th of November 1860 and his inauguration on the 4th of March 1861. And thirdly, there were conservative supporters of the Federal Union, who blamed the crisis on irresponsible radicals in both sections of the country, and who were most prominent in the border slave states and the Upper South. Ultimately, however, it was the Republicans and the immediate secessionists who determined that the crisis would lead to war, because it was they who held the upper hand above and below the Mason-Dixon line. Not all secessions, of course, provoke bitter intercommunal violence. Czechoslovakia, fruit of the Versailles Treaty after World War I, was divided reasonably amicably in the Velvet Divorce of 1993. Quebec's latest bid for independence ended peacefully with a no vote in the 1995 Canadian referendum. And earlier this year, partly Christian Sudan gained its independence from the predominantly Muslim North without plunging the Sudanese peoples into an all-out civil conflagration. The people of the disunited states went to war against one another in April 1861 for two reasons. First, Southern secessionists refused to accept the legitimacy of Lincoln's election. They took their states out of the Union with remarkable celerity. They opposed virtually every meaningful compromise attempt, founded their own separatist government, and then reduced Fort Sumter to rubble. Second, Northern Republicans also opposed significant compromise measures and then refused to acquiesce in peaceable disunion in Confederate independence. So it's the Republican contribution to the coming of the American Civil War that I'm particularly interested in this evening. The Republican Party of the early 1860s was not the conservative political organization we're familiar with today. It came into being in the mid-1850s as an assertive political manifestation of Northerners' rising hostility to the power of the South in national councils, a power that was widely seen as being grounded in the existence of human slavery. Although the new party was a coalition, all Republicans opposed the expansion of slavery into America's Western territories. The party was a regional party in the sense that most of its support came from the northern Free States. But it was national in terms of its avowed commitment to the territorial integrity of the existing Union. To make sense of what happened during the secession crisis, we must acknowledge that civil strife was probable, but not quite inevitable after Lincoln's triumph at the polls. Although many Americans, North and South, feared war, most of them hoped that it could be avoided somehow by passage of compromise measures, as had been the case during another secession crisis in 1850, or the holding of a national convention to amend the Constitution, or by continued restraint on both sides. Popular support in the North for coercing the Southern states back into the Union waxed and waned. It was strong in late 1860 and early 1861, as Northerners reacted angrily to the adoption of secession ordinances in the Cotton States. But then support for military action declined as the Buchanan administration failed to counter Southern assaults on federal property, and as compromise measures were debated inside and outside Congress. Republicans were greatly encouraged when Lincoln announced in his inaugural address that he would enforce the laws, but their spirits began to sink again in late March as press reports indicated that the new administration was on the verge of evacuating Fort Sumter. Republicans did not present an entirely united front during the winter of 1860 to 61. This isn't surprising. The period between Lincoln's election and the attack on Fort Sumter was as confusing for contemporaries as it has proved for subsequent historians. But virtually no Republican, was willing to support the kind of compromise that might have brought the Deep South secessionists, certainly those cautious cooperationists, to the negotiating table. And I'm talking here about the Crittenden Compromise. When the 36th Congress reconvened for its last session early in December of 1860, both the Senate and the House of Representatives raised special committees to formulate proposals to end the secession crisis. The most significant proposal, one that would be debated in one form or another on several occasions in the ensuing 3 months, was introduced by this man. This is Senator John J. Crittenden of Kentucky. The Crittenden Plan included 6 new constitutional amendments, of which the most eye-catching was one protecting slavery south of the line 36 degrees 30 minutes in any territory currently held or, and this is important, or hereafter acquired by the United States. The significance of the line 36 degrees 30 minutes was that this was the line of latitude delineating the border between slave and free territory in the Missouri Compromise of 1820. And you can see that line on the screen there in front of you below the territory marked in blue, unorganized territory. Note that at that time, US possessions did not include the entire modern Southwest, which, as you can see, then belonged to Spain. This vast domain did not fall into American hands until the United States' crushing military victory over Mexico in 1848. So Crittenden's proposal was basically to extend the Missouri Compromise line to the West Coast, which of course by 1860, 61, all those Spanish possessions are now in American hands. Slavery would be protected above the line, below the line rather, but was not to exist above 36 degrees, 30 minutes. The Crittenden Plan not only offered Southerners the chance to spread slavery into the Southwest, into Central America and the Caribbean, it also drove a coach and horses through the Republican signature policy of no more slavery expansion. The four Deep South delegates on the Senate Committee of 13 agreed to support the Crittenden Compromise in early December, but only if the Republicans on the committee gave it their backing, and they refused. Throughout the secession crisis, Republicans either opposed any compromise with the South, or like Abraham Lincoln and his Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, they supported only limited concessions intended not to appeal to cooperationists in the Deep South, but to ensure that conservative border slave states like Virginia did not join their peers. The Republicans' opposition to the kind of sectional armistice that might have staved off civil war is usually depicted as a function of ideology and politics, of their determination as Northern nationalists to preserve the Union intact, and of their concern that any diminution of their opposition to slavery expansion would destroy the party. There can be no question that concerns for the future of the new anti-slavery organization played a central role in the Republicans' lack of enthusiasm for compromise, particularly at the grassroots. And knowing as we do that over 600,000 American lives were lost in the ensuing bloodbath, it's hard not to be cynical when we discover abundant evidence that the victorious Republicans appear to have been more interested in parceling out federal jobs and holding the party together than looking out for the country's welfare. As one prominent Republican put it succinctly to Lincoln in early January, "If you waver, our party has gone." I say appear more interested because Republicans like this Illinois congressman genuinely believed that support for the party and love of country were one and the same thing. In their eyes, the Republicans had won the presidential contest of 1860 fairly and squarely on an anti-slavery extension platform. The new administration would improve and strengthen the United States, they held, by committing it to a glorious future, one that would be built on productive, meritocratic free labor, not on a system of inefficient slave labor that was condemned by what passed for the civilized world in the mid-19th century. But while a strong commitment to maintaining the anti-slavery Republican Party as the agent of future American greatness helps to explain its devotees' opposition to compromise, it doesn't tell the whole story. Swirling historical memories of all kinds help to influence the way that individuals and groups reacted during the secession crisis, impelling them not only to draw what they took to be meaningful parallels between the past and the present, but also to act upon those putative lessons of history. For example, on learning that Major Robert Anderson's garrison in Charleston Harbor was rapidly running out of provisions, President Lincoln asked the members of his new cabinet for written advice on whether Fort Sumter should be evacuated. On this occasion, a majority replied in the affirmative. Simon Cameron, the Secretary of War, argued that reinforcement would require the dispatch of at least 20,000 men and make the harbor a Sebastopol, an allusion to the protracted 15 and a half month Allied siege of the imposing Russian fortress in the Crimea, which had gripped the Western world in 1854-55. Edward Bates, the Attorney General, premised his argument for withdrawal on the impending threat of servile war, bloody slave insurrection in a destabilized South. Although he did not make the parallel specifically, Bates was conjuring up memories of events like the bloody Haitian rebellion, the slave rebellion of 1791 to 1804, in which thousands of whites and untold numbers of blacks had been slaughtered. The only cabinet member to counsel reinforcement at this stage was Postmaster General Montgomery Blair. Blair's comments were based on his understanding of the 1832-33 nullification crisis, when President Andrew Jackson had used his executive powers to thwart South Carolina's attempts to reject federal authority. "It is obvious," urged Blair, "that rebellion was checked in 1833 by the promptitude of the president in taking measures which made it manifest that it could not be attempted with impunity, and that it, i.e. rebellion, has grown to its present formidable proportions only because similar measures were not taken. The fact that three leading Republicans could muster different events from the past to justify conflicting counsel to the president highlights the pliability of historical memory. It's a fairly obvious point I'm making here. We saw the same thing recently when British politicians were debating the wisdom of intervening to support anti-Gaddafi rebels in Libya. Whereas some cited memories of the Serbian atrocities in Bosnia in the 1990s as justification for UN and NATO action, others warned against UK involvement because they feared getting bogged down in another Iraq. Individuals possess a bewildering array of constructed memories which can be used to justify all manner of actions in the present. Group memories, however, tend to be more cohesive because they must be sifted and tested before they can assume the status of grand narratives. But when they do assume the status, these sprawling fictions have the capacity to exert a controlling force on collective behavior. Republican responses to the secession crisis in the United States were conditioned in part by their embrace of a synthetic historical narrative, which held the secession crisis to be the greatest trial yet for the American experiment in republicanism, one that could be passed only by facing down treacherous Southern demagogues. The Republican grand narrative combined elements of national and group memory. It was socially constructed, the product of inherited knowledge, religious instruction, lived experience, and collective self-interest. Linear in progression and often suffused with a belief in an imminent God, it looked back to colonial times. It incorporated national memories of the American Revolution and sectional recollections of the more recent American past. And it drew explanatory power from the distant and modern history of other countries. Shards of this narrative appeared in many places. The private correspondence of individual Republicans, the speeches of party leaders, and the editorials of the age's fiercely partisan press. An article in the Morning Courier and New York Inquirer illustrates my point. It's worth quoting at length. This Republican paper was one of the strongest advocates of coercion in the North. On the 8th of January 1861, its editor James Watson Webb outlined his reasons for suppressing those who have plotted treason. He began by acknowledging that the horrors of civil war are made familiar to every student of history, but added that these were the greatest curse that can befall any people, save only the anarchy which civil war is designed to prevent. Modern governments, he insisted, were the legitimate fruits of 6,000 years of experiment and experience. The greatest of them all, in terms of its influence on others, was the United States. Its seeds were planted in America by God in his providence, then nurtured during the Revolution by our fathers, who were tested by God in a 7 years civil war with the mightiest nation of the earth and in the school of adversity and suffering. The result was the American Republic, the union of these states, intended to secure to our fathers, to us, and to our descendants forever the blessings of civil and religious liberty, and to become not only an asylum, but a beacon light to the oppressed of the old world, teaching by our example the ability of man for self-government. As proof of America's didactic purpose, Webb proffered the Constitution's prohibition of the African slave trade, which led to the infernal traffic, in his words, being ultimately proclaimed piracy by the Christian world. The Southern Rebellion, insisted the editor, had to be confronted if the blessings of the Union were to be transmitted unimpaired to posterity, even at the cost of civil war, the duration of which no man can calculate. Webb's analysis set out the essential framework of the Republicans' distinctive grand narrative of American history. The United States was God's gift to the world. Traitors and rebels, bound together in the cause of human slavery, were conspiring to destroy it. The only response of true patriots was to put it down, to put them down. In singling out the American Revolution as the central event in American and world history, Webb's editorial was far from unrepresentative. It highlighted the emotional bond which existed between the Civil War generation and its revolutionary precursor. Even though most Revolutionary War veterans were dead by the spring of 1861, the legendary deeds of the Minutemen, of the Continental Army, and of the Founding Fathers exercised a strong pull on all Americans during the secession crisis. Like all historical memories, Revolutionary War memory was immensely plastic. It remains so today. Just look at the attempts of modern Tea Party activists to employ it in the service of their conservative political agenda. Disunionists used it to make their case against the Republicans, who they argued had perverted the founders' experiment by waging war against the South and its lawful institution of slavery. When the Confederacy was born in February 1861, many of its leaders insisted that their new nation was the legitimate heir of the original republic. They contrasted it with the contemporary United States, which had been ruined by greedy Yankees, hypocritical abolitionists, and ignorant European immigrants. Compromisers of all stripes, some Republicans among them, appealed to the country's revolutionary past in order to foster amity between Northerners and at least some Southerners. The best-known use of historical memory during the entire secession crisis involved the application of Revolutionary War memory. Invited to comment on a draft of President Lincoln's inaugural address in late February 1861, Secretary of State William Henry Seward suggested an important addition to the peroration, one that would soften the new president's uncompromising statement that the nation's perpetuity was confirmed by the history of the Union. In the final paragraph of his 4th of March speech, delivered on the steps, as you can see, of an unfinished Capitol building in Washington, Lincoln urged Southerners to remember that the Union was a common enterprise, bathed at the creation in the blood of patriot heroes from all parts of the 13 colonies. "I am loath to close," he remarked. "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." Secretary of State Seward's design in recommending that Lincoln should appeal to Southerners' better nature on the basis of a common revolutionary heritage was to begin the process of reconstructing the Union by keeping the border slave states, particularly Virginia, from joining the Confederacy. If a clash could be averted at Fort Sumter, Seward hoped, the passage of time would enable Southern Unionists to gain the upper hand over secessionists. In trying to head off civil war, Seward saw himself as acting in the mold of one of the leading personalities of the American War of Independence. Not an indigenous patriot hero, as one might expect, but William Pitt, 1st Earl of Chatham, the former British leader who tried to prevent war between Britain and its rebellious colonists in the early 1770s. But just as Chatham's ultimate aim was to preserve the empire, Seward did not prioritize peace over maintaining the Union. Like most Republicans, like a majority of Northerners, he regarded the United States as a missionary nation whose special purpose was to spread the blessings of liberty, republicanism, and democracy across the globe, a purpose that was now imperiled by the actions of hot-headed traitors. As James Watson Webb's commonplace reference to Southerners plotting treason indicated, the notion of a pro-slavery conspiracy to pervert and, if necessary, destroy the Union also played a central role in the compelling grand narrative that helped condition the dominant Republican response to secession. This was a function of group memory, of their anti-slavery interpretation of American political history since the Revolution. The nodal points of this interpretation were many. They included the infamous three-fifths clause of the United States Constitution, sanctioned by Northern delegates at the 1787 Constitutional Convention as a compromise to assuage Southern slaveholders' fears that their property holdings might be threatened by the more perfect union created at Philadelphia. Under the three-fifths clause, slaves were counted as three-fifths of a person for the purposes of taxation and apportionment, thereby inflating the political power of white Southerners. During the early years of the early Republic, this measure was frequently cited by Northern members of the short-lived Federalist and Jeffersonian Republican parties as the reason for their perceived second-class status within the Union, an inferiority evidenced, as they saw it, by the almost uninterrupted procession of Southern slaveholding presidents, all Virginians elected between 1788 and 1820. It was not until the late 1830s, however, that significant numbers of Northerners began to argue that an ambitious coterie of large slaveholding planters, the so-called slave power, was actually plotting to destroy the best government on earth for its own hellish purposes. Political events between 1832 and 1861 provided the Republicans with what they saw as incontestable evidence to support this conspiracy theory. The resulting historical narrative ran like this. During the nullification crisis of 1832-33, South Carolinians, acting on the treasonous nullification doctrine of the planter ideologue John C. Calhoun, had tried to break up the Union, but had been thwarted, firstly, by decisive executive action on the part of President Andrew Jackson, and secondly, by a congressional compromise over tariff protection engineered by Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky. In the 1840s, Southern slaveholders led by Presidents John Tyler and James Polk had striven to expand slavery into the far west, first by annexing the independent slaveholding Republic of Texas to the Union, and then engineering a war of aggression against Mexico. When Northerners opposed these brazen attempts to obtain new land for slavery, Southerners had renewed their threats to destroy the Union. Once again, Northerners' love of country induced them to compromise over slavery in order to prevent secession. In 1850, some of their delegates in Congress helped to pass a new Fugitive Slave Act, which bound their constituencies to assist federal marshals in the recapture of runaway slaves and allowed white settlers in territories ceded by the defeated Mexicans to decide the status of slavery for themselves. 4 years later, Northerners saw the Southern plotters rip up the Missouri Compromise Agreement and replace it with the Kansas-Nebraska Act. This act abrogated the 1820 strictures against slavery expansion above the 36-30 line. So all the land marked in sort of reddish pink on the screen there, all that land above the old Missouri Compromise line was opened up to slavery by the Kansas-Nebraska Act, at least in theory. The Kansas-Nebraska Act was the alleged villainy that prompted formation of the modern Republican Party. It was denounced as part and parcel of an atrocious plot to extend slavery's domain at the expense of freedom. This sordid goal was further promoted in the second half of the 1850s by pro-slavery violence in Kansas. By the US Supreme Court's decision in the Dred Scott case, the Congress could not interfere with slaveholders' constitutional property rights in the Western Territories. By the Buchanan administration's efforts to secure the admission of Kansas as a slave state. And by the attempts of American adventurers, so-called filibusters, to impose slavery on Central America. Now, at the moment when Northerners had finally wrested political control of the country from the hands of the slave power, Southern fire eaters were again threatening to secede in order to procure Northern acquiescence in the most craven compromise yet. The plausibility of this grand narrative influenced the Republicans' responses during the secession crisis in several ways. For example, the stress on the activities of a relatively small group of pro-slavery plotters led them initially to underestimate popular support for secession. Some of the party's leading figures were so convinced that an elite conspiracy was afoot that they employed a private detective in Washington to uncover it. The narrative's chief function, however, was to convince Republican leaders and activists that further compromise was dangerous. It would demoralize the party, and because the party's success was essential to the future well-being of the Union, it would destroy the Founding Fathers' sanctified experiment in republicanism and democracy. Hostility towards the kind of compromise that could have brought leading cooperationists in the Deep South to the negotiating table, hostility above all else to the Crittenden Compromise, was conditioned largely by the Republicans' interpretation of Southern aggressions in the American past. Francis Preston Blair, Sr., a member of Andrew Jackson's cabinet during the nullification crisis, wrote to President-elect Lincoln on the 14th of January, 1861. As well as urging Lincoln not to appoint William Seward, Secretary of State, in Blair's view, Seward was a scheming politician in the mould of the corrupt 18th century British Prime Minister, Robert Walpole. Blair assailed the Crittenden plan to extend the Missouri Compromise line to the Pacific and to protect slavery below it. The South, he contended, was now seeking conquest and slave empire. Whereas its politicians had previously nullified the Missouri Compromise in order to spread slavery, they now wanted to revive it to do the same thing on a larger scale. It was, he urged, time to stop Southerners' game of open and shut with these compromises. Many Republican editors made the same point to a wider readership. Every man is acquainted with the history of the Missouri Compromise, claimed one Indiana paper. That was declared constitutional by the Democratic Party, and it repealed it. Shall we make another sacrifice of freedom by another compromise to be broken at the will of the South? The history of the Missouri Compromise teaches every intelligent man that compromise is useless. My point is not that this coherent account of continual slave power aggressions and periodic humiliating Northern compromises made all Republicans act the same way during the secession crisis. As I've already suggested, William Seward's reading of the country's past dating back to the American Revolution helped to condition his anti-coercion approach during the tense early months of 1861. Some radical Republicans, especially in the immediate wake of Lincoln's election, argued in favor of letting the cotton states go in peace rather than yield more ground to slavery in the shape of another disastrous compromise. The key point is, however, that neither Seward nor anti-slavery radicals, initially tolerant of peaceable secession, were willing to back the Crittenden Compromise, the only compromise that might have prevented secession and civil war. And so to that extent, they too operated in the shadow of the Republican grand narrative of American history. Northern Republicans were not the only group to draw upon a usable past in 1860 to 61. Virginia conservatives, among them Robert E. Lee, were heavily influenced by a conviction that their state had played a formative role in the development of the United States. Memories of Virginia's historic paramountcy motivated the conservatives' involvement in the abortive Washington Peace Conference, which met in February to find a practical solution to the Republic's gravest national crisis. As Professor Elizabeth Varon reminded us in her fine Cunliffe Center lecture in March, the Republicans' refusal to defer to Virginia's leadership contributed directly to Lee's decision to join the Confederacy. And by this time, Deep South secessionists had already drawn effectively on their own potent historical memory to promote immediate disunion. Their grand narrative was bolstered by some of the same War of Independence creation myths as the Republican variant. However, it differed radically from the latter in several ways, especially its emphasis on Northerners alleged refusal to abide by the Founding Fathers' compromises over slavery, and fears about what lustful, unshackled blacks would do to white women were embedded within the secessionist narrative, sanctioned not only by evidence that the Republicans were crypto-abolitionists, motivated by a desire to deprive slaveholders of their constitutional right to own human beings, but also by powerful memories of previous slave revolts, including the ferocious Haitian slave rebellion against the French, and also Nat Turner's unsuccessful slave revolt in Virginia in 1831. In 1860 to 61, the impact of social memory on the United States appears to have been largely centrifugal. Republicans and secessionists recalled and interpreted the American past as members of competing sections. However, the two main components of Republican memory exercised a dual influence on Republican responses to secession. While the Republicans' anti-slavery account of American history since 1787 rendered them hostile to the kind of compromise that might have staved off civil war by at least dividing the secessionists of the Deep South, the sentimental creation myths of the Revolution ultimately led them to reject peaceable disunion. To most Republicans, Abraham Lincoln included, history rendered the Union an unbreakable whole. If it proved necessary to fight and kill misguided Southerners to save it, then so be it. Although this year's sesquicentennial commemorations have been modest compared with the centennial observances of 1961, internet blogs over the last few months have highlighted Americans' continuing fascination with the Civil War. A recent essay on the Crittenden Compromise, which appeared on the New York Times website, sparked a typically fierce debate. Some contributors were more inclined to sound off than engage with the issues. One reader gratuitously denounced the radical abolitionist John Brown as the Bin Laden of the 1850s. Pablo from Houston stirred up a hornet's nest by insisting that the southern states had every right to secede. "Your argument is simply silly, know-nothing Tea Party rhetoric," retorted an angry liberal from Washington, D.C. Most of the posts, however, were thoughtful and engaged. Several respondents enunciated their objection to a compromise that would have permitted the expansion of slavery. "The Crittenden proposals would have reversed the decision of the electorate," wrote one. "What a horrible, two-faced country we would have been had this compromise been accepted," contended another. The fact that the rejection of the Crittenden plan paved the way for civil war didn't seem to bother most visitors to the site. "The war's outcome was happy," commented one respondent, "and its fighting was necessary. Slavery could not have ended without it and would certainly have continued into the 20th century without a war." This last posting reflects the grip of what is today the reigning master narrative of the American Civil War. Sure, the conflict was tragic, but hey, let's be thankful. It saved the Union, and it liberated 4 million slaves from bondage. Without it, the United States might not have been strong enough to defeat Hitler in the 1940s. Personally, I find this kind of self-serving triumphalism more than a little unsettling. The Civil War was a disgusting event. I'm pretty sure I would not have wanted to fight in it, even if it did free 4 million slaves. As a historian, I understand why most Republicans were so ardently opposed to the kind of compromise that might, just might, have prevented Americans from drenching Columbia's woods and fields in blood in the 1860s. Convinced because of their attachment to an anti-slavery reading of the nation's remote and recent past, that the well-being of the party and the country required Northerners to stand up to Southern treason and aggression, they opted for coercion over what they regarded as humiliation. I'm not sure I blame them for that, but it behoves all historians of this divisive period to recognize the appalling human cost of their decision.